Our guest editor this morning, P.D. James, was a governor of the BBC from 1988 to 1993. For her programme, she wanted to interview the corporation's Director-General, Mark Thompson. So that's what she did.
Well, Director-General, my affection for the BBC is rooted really in childhood, because I was born in 1920 and I think the BBC came into existence in 1923. And thereafter, I heard it in my home virtually every day of my life. But basically, I think it has changed. And to me, sometimes it seems like a very large and unwieldy ship that's been floating there since 1920, taking on more and more and more cargo, building more decks to accommodate it, recruiting more officers, all very comfortably cabined, usually at salaries far greater than their predecessors enjoyed, and with a crew somewhat discontented and some a little mutinous, the ship rather sinking close to the Plimsoll line, and the customers feeling they've paid too much for the journey and not quite sure where they're going, or indeed who is the captain. And that may be a little unfair, but it's basically, I think, how a lot of people might see the BBC, as being basically very unwieldy and very bureaucratic, and less clear about what it should be doing.
Well, I mean, I think that where the world has definitely changed is that once upon a time, when the BBC was the home service, this radio station we're on at the moment, it's now Radio 4, but the home service of the BBC and the light programme, it was very clear what the BBC was and what it wasn't. But in that world of digital media, defining what you do and what you don't do is not, it's not a, you know, it's not to do with, you know, X number of TV stations or X number of radio stations. You need to decide very clearly what your priorities are. And I have to say, I do think we have priorities. I mean, the best journalism in the world, for example, is absolutely one of the priorities of the BBC. Outstanding programmes and content for children is a priority.
I think it is really quite easy to name and pick out programmes of superb quality. Superb quality. But occasionally, if one opens the Radio Times and, as it were, puts a ruler across showing which, it would be, and said to someone, which is the BBC, which is public service broadcasting, it might not be very easy to pick out. Perhaps rather unkindly.
Well, go on, you need to give me now a couple of shockers that I can respond
well,
to.
Well, we've had Britain's most embarrassing pets, Britain's tallest man, Britain's worst teeth, dog Borstal. Help me, Althea, I'm infested. Subject was Anthea Turner, an exterminator, takes agencies, making homekeepers miserable. And my life as an animal.
I missed dog Borstal. I don't know whether you managed to catch
no,
it.
I didn't see dog Borstal. My life has never been, it's been much poorer, I'm sure, for not being dog Borstal.
Sounds potentially rather interesting.
Know, and well, there are things. And also there is a tendency to want to go, you know, head on head with the opposition. I think there was a bit of that with Strictly Dancing, wasn't it?
Strictly Come Dancing. No, there was a fuss this autumn about whether, I mean, I have to say, when we talk to the public, one of the things the public tell us at large is, although actually there used to be, frankly, in what people call the golden age of television, there used to be an awful lot of entertainment and quiz shows on BBC One. There's actually much less entertainment than there used to be. But the public do tell us they want entertainment from the BBC on Saturday evenings. One of the things on a Saturday evening they want is something the whole family can watch together. Yes. And I have to say, not surprisingly, therefore, our Saturday night entertainment sometimes clashes with ITV's Saturday night entertainment for obvious reasons. And I think if that was a regular, if every day of the week we were going head-to-head. Yes. But I would say if you looked at the BBC One schedule and the ITV One schedule today, they are more different than they've been at any time in the history of the BBC.
But getting back to Strictly Come Dancing, that's not only head-on-head, but then, you see, I watch that because it's jolly and it's colourful and you're watching people who are being very, very clever. And then, of course, one of the best of the judges disappears and it could only have been kind of ageism. Let's have a pretty girl here, let's have a pretty girl. And then it becomes an obvious, it's another game show in a way. The public have the last word and who's popular will probably go through and everybody's enjoying it. But the reason I watched it has gone, so I don't watch it.
Well, we've
no longer enjoy it.
I mean, one thing you'd be pleased about, Arlene Phillips is coming back in a new dance programme on BBC One in the new year. So you won't...
Well, probably a response to the sort of outrage when she went. And the other response was to say that you were going to look for a news leader over 50. Now, that was really a bit of an insult.
Well, I think what I want to say...
But it's not a question of looking for a news leader over 50. It's something that's imbued there, that there is a kind of ageism that is there in the BBC at present.
Well, I think that what I want to say is that what we should do on radio, on television, is we should try and find people with the best talent, the best,
exactly,
the most experienced journalists,
exactly,
frankly, from whatever background and whatever age.
Exactly.
And I would, you know, as it happens, I don't believe that the decision that was taken around Arlene Phillips was ageism. But, you know, insofar as, you know, from time to time, people make decisions on the basis of age, they really shouldn't. I mean, I think that the general point, which is, should the BBC be trying harder to make sure it reflects different ages on the air, and in particular in the context of women, and whether there's still room in the middle of the television and radio schedules for you know, women, if I can say this, you know, without being, you know, too impolite, you know, older women. I think that's, we should look at that. I don't think we want to fall into the trap of, you know, a kind of commercial TV view about ageism and all of that. So, I mean, I think that's one of the things that, although we can argue about the individual cases, the broad point that the BBC should take this issue seriously and do something about it is one I would accept, definitely. Mm. When we make mistakes, I have to say, we need to learn from them. But I can't promise that we won't make mistakes in 2010.
But nobody's asking you to promise that you won't make mistakes. I think we ought to get on to a subject which you would expect me to raise, I know, and which is of immense concern, I think, to many people outside, and that is the salary structure, if indeed there is a structure, and the extraordinarily large salaries that are paid. And I think this goes with a feeling, and I think I'm probably right here, that somehow the people who are doing the creative work, who are making the programmes, don't receive this largesse. It seems to be a huge, great waste of middle management, a bureaucracy which is very difficult indeed to justify. I mean, it really is quite extraordinary when you think of it. About 375 earn over 100,000, 37 plus, more than the Prime Minister. Well, the Prime Minister, no doubt, is probably underpaid, but an organisation that has 37 of its managers earning more than the Prime Minister surely ought to ask itself, you know, is this really justified?
Well, though I think that if it, like you know, other walks of life, I think most people would accept that if you want to have the best people working for the BBC, delivering the best programmes and the best services, and if you also accept that means that, particularly at a moment in broadcasting history where people can move very freely from the BBC to other broadcasters and back, the BBC has to bear, to some extent, in mind the external market. Now, you know, if you take, you know, someone who's going to be the controller of BBC One, they're going to be spending about £1 billion a year on television programmes for that channel. You really want to make sure you've got the very best person doing that job. Now, the current controller of BBC One, we appointed, she was working outside the BBC, working for a commercial broadcaster, and we got her to come back. Now, she will, like most of the people on that list, if not all of the people, get less for the BBC than they were earning or could earn outside. They have to come and take a pay cut. But I think it's a false economy to say, well, you know what, we're not going to have anyone as a controller of BBC One who earns more than £100,000, because you won't get, in my view, you won't get the right candidates for the job.
But, Director General, nobody is saying you don't have anybody who's not earning more than £100,000. They're sort of asking
why people
have £400,000 for jobs, which one wonders what exactly these people are doing. And I think the old argument, you've got to pay these huge salaries because otherwise you don't keep them. Where, in fact, are they going to go?
Well,
when you say that they get outside, where are they going that are going to pay? I mean, if they're 200,000, 400,000 a year, where are they going to go outside which is going to pay them more than that? I don't see where these jobs are in the private sector. Seems so extraordinary.
The private broadcasters, as you know, are ITV, Channel 4.
But ITV is in a very desperate state, and so is Channel 4. If they're paying more than you're paying, they must be in a desperate state, frankly.
There is no evidence yet, although, in common with the BBC, it may well be that there are individual adjustments, and there were quite a few commercial broadcasters, for example, not paying bonuses. But actually, the answer is we are still absolutely losing key staff to commercial broadcasters who are still paying top dollar.
I'm sorry to press this so much, but when I sort of look at marketing, we have a director of marketing, communications and audiences who gets over 300. And then there's a director of communications. Well, I thought that's what the previous director was doing, and he gets 225. And then there's a director of brand and plan. Then there's a director of audiences. Well, we've already got a director of marketing, communications and audiences. Then we've got a director of marketing, communications and audiences. How different is he from the director of marketing, communications and audiences above? It's vast sums of money, and one wonders really, you know, what actually is going on here. I'm just not convinced that we need to pay this amount of money.
You need to think about the scale of what the BBC does in this country. I mean, to give you one example, we have something like 12 million personal interactions with members of the British public every year. We need to do audience research and to listen to the public about our programmes and services. Yes. We do need a complicated press operation. I mean, in a typical week...
Yes, I can see you would.
There are hundreds and hundreds of pages each day about the BBC in the press.
In other words, really what you're saying, Director Jim, that this criticism I'm making, that there is an overwhelming burden of bureaucracy, and that I feel that really the people who are producing the programmes, and the really creative people are not getting a fair deal, that is something that you actually reject. You are happy with what is now here.
Well, we've over the last 5 years, we've tried to reduce our overhead cost and to reduce the burden of overheads. I know, Phyllis, that you've worked yourself in the public service for many, many years. And of course we know, and everyone listening to this will know, that to some extent public sector bureaucracies, it's a many-headed hydra. You cut off one head and two more appear.
Another one shows.
Let's be honest about the fact that it's a real issue.
One
of the things that we're looking at is whether we can simply make an auditable, fully accountable commitment to how much of the licence fee we actually spend on content. And the BBC, it's interesting, the ratio between top pay and average pay in the BBC is not high by even public sector standards, and it's much, much lower than in the private sector. The difference between average pay in the BBC and my pay is something like 17 times, which seems like a great deal. In the FTSE 100, it's well over 100 times.
I always feel that this comparison, which we always make with the private sector, is really unreal. I mean, the private sector is in a desperate situation. People are losing their jobs. People are unable to get jobs who come out of university well qualified. And we know some of the reasons for this. And any sort of public body is really so protected against all these pressures. And people really... I like to think here they are doing a job which they see as a public service, which indeed it is. And I don't think you can always have it two ways. You can't sort of be bringing around your 400,000, your 500,000 a year and think you're performing a public service if, in fact, that is overpayment for what you're really doing. And it should be really a privilege, I think, to work for this organisation.
Well, I think it really is a privilege. And everyone here, in the senior echelons anyway, should accept that in some way there will be a very big discount. They will get paid much less than they could earn outside the BBC. And I have to say, if you talk to people who work in the BBC, it's a very disputatious place, and people in this organisation argue about everything all the time. I think one thing we don't argue about is our continued collective belief
in what this institution stands for. And what public service broadcasting should be.
And I have to say, I believe that if John Reith and his colleagues, the people who founded the BBC, came into today's BBC, they will be surprised and I hope heartened by the fact that people inside the BBC still have a passionate enthusiasm for what they do.
Thank you very much.